Welcome to Whiskey Cask, Cask Strength Conversation, featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 340 for October 23rd, 2011. Support for Whiskey Cask comes from Redbreast Single Pot Still Irish Whiskey. Find out more at redbreastwhiskey.com and join the Stillhouse to get your own personalized whiskey journal. Coming up in a few minutes.
You know, I was a lone wolf for a long time. It's kind of nice not to be the only one on the shelf. I mean, over the years, people looked at it, you know, with skepticism. What's this guy doing, you know?
Chuck Miller was a craft distiller when craft distilling wasn't popular. Chuck inherited his grandfather's moonshine-making skills and most of his equipment and started making legally licensed moonshine 25 years ago at his Stillhouse Distillery in Culpeper, Virginia. Chuck's original moonshine was only available in Virginia state stores until last year when it went on sale in New York. I'll have that story with Chuck Miller later on, along with the calendar of events, the comments of the week, and the What I'm Tasting This Week department. First off, let's look at the week's news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie. You may not be familiar with the Lawrenceburg Distillery in Lawrenceburg, Indiana, but if you've ever tried Templeton Rye, Bullet Rye, or some of the High West whiskeys, you're more familiar than you might think. LDI produces raw and aged bourbon and rye spirit under contract for those brands and many others. It was known for many years as the Seagram's Distillery, and Pernod Ricard sold it off to Angostura owner CL Financial back in 2007. LDI has operated under a cloud of secrecy since then, but that's about to change. Kansas-based MGP Ingredients has signed an agreement to buy the distillery for about $15 million, while the adjacent bottling plant will be sold off to another buyer. MGP produces neutral grain spirits for vodka and gin production, along with fuel-grade ethanol and agricultural products. Last year, we met Dr. Pierce Lyons, the founder of Alltech and a native of Ireland. His Lexington Brewing Company grew out of the company's yeast production business, and several years ago, the brewery added a still and started making whiskey. When we met Dr. Lyons, he'd just introduced Pierce Lyons Reserve Single Malt Whiskey. Now he's unveiled Town Branch Bourbon, named for the spring that runs underneath Lexington. The bourbon will be available first at next month's National Horse Show at the Kentucky Horse Park. Andrew Weir and Nicholas Palacki of the Balvenie are wrapping up what could be the ultimate road trip. The Balvenie brand ambassadors have been driving around the U.S. in a classic Morgan Roadster, visiting artisans and their workshops. I caught up with Andrew the other night in New York City at the end of this chapter in the Balvenie Road Show.
We started in Key West back in March, and we've driven all the way around the U.S. We've done the four corners of the country, and we find ourselves now in New York on the last couple of weeks of the trip. And we've been able to visit artisans, craftspeople, people who make things by hand all over the country, and it's been a pretty incredible journey.
Such as.
So I'm going to start at the very first day when we went to Key West, and we met a guy called Markham McGill. Now, completely coincidentally, Markham is a whiskey drinker, which is great. So he was really keen to taste the stuff when we got there. But Markham makes longboards. Now, I have to confess, when I went down there, I thought a longboard was like a surfboard. And I'm glad to tell you I didn't show up in my wetsuit, because the world doesn't have to see me in a wetsuit. But yeah, Markham makes longboards, so long skateboards. Makes them from reclaimed wood, all, you know, some found objects, some found wood. Puts the trucks on, and he makes these really... I suppose it's a luxury longboard. And, you know, that was mile marker zero. So we worked our way north. We've seen boat builders, hat makers. We visited a really interesting 26-year-old female blacksmith in the 9th Ward in New Orleans, a lady called Rachel David, who produces a number of different items with steel and iron. But what was amazing about Rachel was she makes all of her own tools, as many blacksmiths do. So she made her own forge, she makes her own hammers and basically all of her tools. So that's like the original craft. So we've just unearthed a whole... I met a guy last week in Boston, a guy called Matt Rogers with a company called Wall Pusher. And Matt actually was 13 years old, keen musician, standing in a music store in New York, and he heard a bass guitar player from, I think, the band The Saw Doctors, he said, and or maybe the spin doctors, one of the doctors, and he stood next to this bass player, and the guy behind the counter quoted this gentleman $16,000 for his guitar. And so this young 13-year-old guy said, how on earth can I pay $16,000 for a bass guitar? And he said, you know what, I'm going to make one. And I held this guitar that he made when he was 13, and it's incredible. And it looks the same as all the other guitars, the thousands of guitars that he's made since. But he makes them again from reclaimed wood. He starts with chunks of wood, cuts them to size, sands them down, glues them together, and produces these incredible decorative instruments that not only play well, but look like, you know, antiques.
So are you guys going to get them some Balvenie barrel staves to work with?
Well, we've been asked for that. Actually, Markham, the longboard guy, he was the first guy to ask for staves. Because we visit a lot of woodworkers around the way, you know, violin makers, cello makers. But yeah, a lot of staves have been asked for. Unfortunately, we have quite a few of those. If you go to the compound at the distillery, there's quite a few of those lying around. But it's just been great. You know, it brings us right back to our craftsmen in Scotland. And, you know, being a whiskey that still has Coopers and Maltman and a coppersmith in Dennis, now 53 years in the job, and David Stewart, our ultimate craftsman. It's just nice to be able to kind of tie that in with craftsmanship in America. And we've really unearthed people who, to be honest, probably wouldn't have, you know, they would have just been going about their business. And so we asked them if they would mind being part of the roadshow, and the response has been overwhelmingly positive. They're all catalogued on our website, thebalvenie.com/roadshow. And we've also been able to make a documentary, which will be available towards the end of the year, which charts the journey around the country in the Morgan, and also includes some really interesting footage of us working with these craftspeople and showing their craft. And it's basically a celebration of their craftsmanship.
Now, how reliable was it driving this Morgan around the country? Because this is an old car, to be honest.
Well, actually, this particular model, it's made the old way. It's still made of wood. It's still made by hand. But this is a 2002 model. So when Nicholas and I got it in March, it had 7,000 miles on the clock. It's now got 12,000. So we've managed to clock up some miles on it. And there have been challenging days in the Morgan. I mean, for the most part, it's been a lot of fun. We drive when the weather's nice, the roof's off, and we put our elbow out the window and we drive around America and smile and just have a great time. When the roof's on and it's raining, it's a little bit more challenging, but we soldier on. It's a tough life, but someone's got to do it, Mark. But, you know, it's funny, people ask all the time, you must get, you know, people, women and stuff, you know, shouting things from the side of the road. Absolutely not. I'm here to categorically say that it's only been men 50 to 80 who have been catcalling from the side of the road that love this car.
Or they see the Balvenie on the side of it and they want to know where the whiskey is.
That's a big part of it as well. Obviously, we've got the brand name on the side, the little Roadshow logo. And the car does certainly get a lot of attention. But, you know, as we're celebrating craftsmanship, what better way to do it than in a real, true, handmade vehicle?
The Morgan is going into storage for the winter, but will be brought back out in the spring for another road trip. Looks like Andy Weir probably won't be taking it out, though. He's being promoted to U.S. Brand Manager for the Balvenie at William Grant & Sons USA. He'll replace Laura Gwilliam, who will take on another brand management role within the company. In Scotland, Glengoyne has wrapped up work for the year on upgrades to its visitors center at the distillery near Glasgow. The work includes a redesigned distillery shop and updates to the visitors center, and more work is planned for next year. The distillery says visitor traffic was up 6% this summer. Last time around, we got the latest from Suntory's Mike Miyamoto on the shortages of Yamazaki 12-year-old single malt from Japan. There are also now reports that Laphroaig is running short on supplies of 10-year-old single malt. The drinks business website cites an unnamed Laphroaig spokesman as blaming increased demand for age statement malts in the U.S. and Asia, and the demand could not have been foreseen 10 years ago. Royal Mile Whiskies is branching out, as we heard from Keir Sword earlier this year. The retailer has plans to expand in Scotland under the Drinkmonger label, and the second Drinkmonger location is just opened in Brunsfield. The first location opened in Pitlochry in July. And that's the news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie, unnecessarily well-made. A couple of program notes now. The latest episode of WhiskeyCast HD is available at YouTube and in the iTunes Music Store with a look at one of Scotland's best whiskey bars, the Bon Accord in Glasgow. This month's episode of WhiskeyCast Virtual Tastings is also online now. Our tasting panel of Sean, Tim, and Scott tasted bourbons this time around, Jim Beam Black, Russell's Reserve, and Woodford Reserve, and I think you'll find their results interesting. It's available at the WhiskeyCast website and in the iTunes Music Store. Let's check the inbox for the comments of the week now, brought to you this time around by Highland Park. As soon as I posted word on the Facebook page about the WhiskeyCast HD episode on the monochord, the comments started coming in. David Stewart, not the one from the Balvenie, piped up, "The Bonaccord is my favorite pub in Scotland. I just wish that I could get there more often." And Benjamin Chen in Singapore posted this note, "Great stuff, Mark. I'll definitely make a trip down to the Bonaccord the next time I'm in Glasgow." Meanwhile, Gavin Thompson has developed a Shackleton obsession. He's trying to collect everything he can about the McKinley's Rare Old Highland Malt recreation from White and Mackay, and is looking for flyers, tasting notes, posters, and anything that may have been available at recent festivals, and posted a note on the Facebook page looking for help. If you can help Gavin out, contact him through Facebook. Got a great note from Bob Johnston in Nova Scotia this week. Here's what he had to say. "Hi, Mark. Congratulations on a fine podcast. I've been along for the ride since 2006. Just a note of thanks. I've noticed on the virtual tastings that you've been slipping in some blended whiskey. Thank you. For so long, I've been listening to so-called experts disrespecting blended scotch, and it's about time that somebody stood up for them. My favorite dram is Johnny Walker Gold Label, followed by Blue Label, and when I serve either of these drams to my guests and friends, I feel I'm serving them a quality whiskey. But if you listen to the, quote, experts, I'd be better off cleaning wrenches in them. Keep up the promotion of the premium blends. There are a lot of us out here who respect and love them. Thanks again and cheers, Bob. P.S. If you want a real taste treat, pan-seared Atlantic scallops in a dram of Johnny Walker Blue. It's my New Year's Eve treat." Thanks for the note, Bob. The scallops sound great. If you have something you'd like to share, you can always post it on our Facebook page or just email me. The address is comments@whiskeycast.com. The comments of the week are brought to you this time around by Highland Park.
Hello, this is Jerry Tosh of Highland Park, the makers of the best spirit in the world. If you'd like to go onto the WhiskeyCast website and click on the banner, then it'll take you to the inner circle and sign up, and we'll send you as much information about Highland Park as you'd ever need to know.
Time now for the calendar of events, brought to you as always by Laphroaig. We're in a busy period now with events all over the place. The Scotch Malt Whiskey Society's U.S. chapter continues its series of single malt extravaganzas this week in Washington, D.C. Wednesday and Philadelphia on Friday. Jim McEwen and Willie Tate will go head-to-head at a tasting of Brooklady and Jura whiskeys in New York City on October 31st, the night before the sold-out Whiskey Fest New York on November 1st. The annual Willow Park Whiskey Festival is November 3rd in Calgary, Alberta, followed by the Scotch Malt Whiskey Society's Canadian chapter tasting at Kensington Wine Market in Calgary on the 4th. That night is also Whiskey Live in Toronto, and the start of the Oslo Whiskey Festival weekend in Norway. It's followed the next day by the Milano Whiskey Festival in Italy and the Spirits in the Sky Festival in Zolder, Belgium. Finally, Mahesh Patel's Universal Whiskey Experience is kicking off a series of Dalmore dinners in Washington on November 7th and New York City on the 9th. You'll find a full calendar of events at the WhiskeyCast website, and it's brought to you by Laphroaig. Visit the Laphroaig website at laphroaig.com, and while you're there, become a friend of Laphroaig and claim your own square foot of Islay.
WhiskeyCast, brought to you by Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. In conversation with Barry Crockett, master distiller, Redbreast single pot still Irish whiskey.
My family have been involved in the business. My father was the head distiller or master distiller of the old Middleton Distillery, which ceased operation in 1974. In respect of the handing on of the traditional practices, you could really say it was a family operation handing on the skills from one generation to another, particularly in my case. I actually lived on the site of the distillery, so it wasn't just merely the handing on of practices, it was indeed being very much aware from a very young age of the sounds, the aromas, the people who worked in the business. So it is, as it were, a full immersion in the whiskey business.
Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. Those in the know Redbreast.
Time now for WhiskeyCast In Depth. Chuck Miller describes himself as the first of America's craft distillers. 25 years ago, he started making legal moonshine at his Stillhouse Distillery in Culpeper, Virginia. Until last year, original moonshine, Chuck's label, wasn't sold outside of Virginia, but now it's available in New York City and demand is booming, especially from bartenders and mixologists. Chuck and his wife Jeanette made the trip from Culpeper to New York this week, where we sat down for a chat at the Tipsy Parson Pub with original moonshine brand ambassador Shem Bloom. Culpeper's about 75 miles outside of Washington, D.C., and if you saw the recent Ken Burns documentary on Prohibition, Chuck's role model was one of those bootleggers keeping Washington in whiskey during the dark days.
Just goes back to my grandpa. Grandpa's father was a well-to-do, actually admiral from the Navy, and Grandpa just didn't want that kind of life. He kept sneaking down in Fredericksburg to the lower end of town there, having a ball with everybody, and then when he got older, he decided he was going to make money quick and fast, and that's how he got in the moonshine business.
And how did it work back then? Because this was in the 60s, up until the 60s pretty much, right?
Right. Now, Grandpa started back in the 30s, you know. Back in that era, it was kind of footloose and fancy free. You could do much what you wanted because he would pay off the local sheriff, you know, like everyone did in that era. And then he sold a lot of whiskey to the congressmen and senators, you know. So he had a great market. The only place he wasn't protected, though, is between the farm and going into D.C., you know. Sometimes you'd have trouble with the law. The federal guys would try to get him, you know.
You ever get caught?
You know, he never got caught. He got close a couple times. I know the one big story I always told was Uncle Johnny made a lot of the deliveries, but that one day they knew the heat was on, but Grandpa, he's a tough, rough type of guy, you know, he said, I'll take the delivery. So they loaded him up, had big old Hudson, you know, and he come across 14th Street Bridge area, and you know how you got a little arc to it, and you start back down, he could see they had the road blocked. Anyway, he didn't care. He just gunned it and went on through the roadblock. They shot his back wind out, and he made his delivery and came on back to the farm.
What other stories can you remember from back then that when you were growing up?
There's a lot of funny ones. He had underneath the Howard farmhouse there, he had like a cistern, you know, a cave, you know, system. And he would store a lot of the whiskey down in there. But the only way to get to it was through a hole in the living room floor. But Grandma had one of those big old rocking chairs at the time, you know, with skirts on it. And every time they'd come, they knew they'd get him now. They knew he had it. See, well, she'd go to her rocking chair and start crocheting. And she would just sit there and rock. Well, they'd tear the place apart, you know. And they could never find it. They never caught him, you know.
And then he finally got out of it when he passed on, right?
Well, yeah, you know, as he got older, he slowed down. Of course, the modern law was more technology and getting stricter as times went on, you know, so it was getting harder and harder to do. So he was a little more selective as he got older, and that's when the time I started working with him, you know. When I started hanging around with him, you know, he had all these milk tanks, but he only had one milk cow. It took a while to figure out and slowly worked into it, you know.
How did you finally figure out what was going on when you were a boy?
Grandpa used to sneak me that whiskey all the time, and I didn't exactly know where it was coming from, but eventually you figure it out, you know.
Tell me how this progressed from being your grandfather's bootlegging operation into what you describe really is the first craft distillery in America, 25 years plus.
There you go. It was 25 years ago. Yeah, my wife and I tried to put it all back together now because, you know, Grandpa had gone by then. We had some of the things from Grandpa, but we got us a 2,000-gallon copper pot still made in the 1930s, kind of Prohibition type of thing, you know. And we got all copper tanks. We want to make rebuild exactly what Grandpa did. We had to get a license because I didn't want to get shot at, you know. I didn't think that was a good way of life, you know. but basically, in Virginia now, we've been making our whiskey there for 25 years. But then one day, you know, this guy, Adam Perry Lane, calls me. He's a renowned barbecue chef. Apparently, he had been in the South promoting barbecue. And it seems like barbecue and moonshine go together, you know, and he liked it. He wanted to do it commercially. So he called me one day. He was up in New York here at the time, living up here. He said, Chuck, I think you make the best moonshine in the United States, but we want to come down and talk to you about it. So he came down, and he said, well, what can we do to make it better. And, you know, because it's really good. But he wanted to get involved in this. So we played with different times distilled, different times filtered. And we finally came up with this. I worked on for about 6 months. He'd come dry it back down. I could get another batch ready for him. He'd dry it back down. You know, he'd drive. You never would fly. He'd drive. And then finally we decided we had the best one. And then he got involved with Brad Beckerman, who kind of helped finance and design the bottle. And then, I guess it's been about a year now. We've had it on the shelf, yeah. We launched it in New York. Has it been New York now? Yeah, about a year ago, yeah.
You were selling it in Virginia before, right?
Right. It's been in Virginia, but we've never left the state of Virginia. We always just market locally, but now we're involved with, and now the Deutsch company's involved, and they're helping us promote it, and our goal is to get it all over the United States. See, the deal with moonshine is it was first made in Virginia in the year 1612 by a guy by the name of James Thorpe. He was a colonist living at Jamestown. He had the technology. He met up with the Indians on the banks of the James River, and they had the corn, and that was the first recorded batch of corn whiskey in the United States. And, you know, of course, the King of England, he didn't like that idea. So he was selling the colonists rum, you know, and gin. And they went in the woods and made the moonshine, heck with the king. And then finally, you know, when George Washington became president, they thought they had it made. But then, no, he wants to finance the Revolutionary War. So he starts taxing whiskey, and they had the Whiskey Rebellion. And away it goes underground again. And, of course, the biggest one was Prohibition, 1922, yeah.
How did your grandfather decide, or how did he come up with his recipe? Because one of the questions that a lot of folks asked me to pass along when I said I was going to be talking with you is they wanted to know, how long did it take to get it right? Because if you do this wrong, you can produce some pretty nasty stuff. How long did it take him to get it right to the point where he came up with something good?
Well, I know Grandpa was always a purist, and he is clientele were congressmen and senators, so he always wanted to make the best. Moonshine having been a pure corn product. I mean, if you want to make a true traditional corn whiskey, which was actually what moonshine was intended to be, you stick with all corn. And then you have to distill it at least twice to get something halfway decent to come at. And then by going to distill it four times, we really have the a quality product. But no, he always wanted to be a traditional American drink, and he's trying to keep it constant, you know. And I'm taking over in the same way. I want to. We raise all our corn there on the farm. We make all our yeast, propagate our yeast there. We even make our own malt. So we're doing everything like Grandpa did. I mean, it's like it's been done in the United in North America here for the last 400 years. So this is a truly an American product.
But how did he figure out where to cut the heads and the tails off when you don't have a lot of scientific equipment like distilleries have now in modern times? How did he figure out where to make the cuts so that he kept the poisonous stuff out?
Well, you know, Grandpa did leave me his all his tools, his instrumentation. So he was pretty sophisticated. So I really can't tell you exactly what he was doing. He didn't keep notes. I guess that wouldn't have been a good idea back in that era. But I do have his hydrometer and his all his gauges and everything he used. So apparently he was very involved into it because he had to make quality moonshine for those congressmen and senators.
Because that would have brought the law down if he'd gotten one sick, right?
Oh, yeah. If he'd have made bad stuff, he would have been in big trouble, yeah.
Now, tell me about the difference between your corn whiskey moonshine and the stuff that often gets passed off as moonshine that folks make with sugar and whatever they can get their hands on, and the stuff that sort of is commonly sold today as moonshine.
Well, yeah, moonshine does incorporate a big, broad area. Basically, what's going on in the woods today, these guys make their own tanks, and they have a little hole on the top of the tank and where they put the corn in, the water in, you know, and they make a traditional moonshine, the first batch. But they don't like to get rid of the mash. Of course, they're in the woods, and they don't want to attract any dogs or BATF agents. You know, it can be. So what they'll do is go to the store and get sugar, and they'll dump back in the old mash and let it re-ferment. Wait about 3 or 4 days, come back and distill it again, and they'll do it again. They'll put the sugar in there. I mean, they'll have what they call batches A, B, C, D, and F, you know. It gets little different every time you go down the line. But but when they think the heat's coming or there's something pressure's coming on them, they have their little dome. They take off the tank, which goes to the back of their pickup truck, and then they leave the tank of Old Mash behind and build another tank and move to another spot. So you're not getting pure quality moonshine each time from those guys, you know. Where you take me, I actually get inspections by the federal government, the state government, and the United States Department of Agriculture. So I make a quality product, and the government's there to back me up.
I have to ask, and you can feel free to answer this if you want to or not, was there ever a time when you made it without the government backing you up?
Well, I've been legal now for 25 years, so we're just going to have to leave it at that.
I think the statute of limitations has expired, but I'll let it go at that. Are you surprised, because I know you've claimed this title of the first craft distiller in America, are you surprised by everything we see on the shelves these days? You come into a restaurant like this, and you're going to find so-called white whiskey from all over the country, from places that I have to say probably wouldn't know what moonshine was if you held their nose open and poured it down their throats. And it's being sold as legal moonshine. What do you think when you see all these bottles that pop up somewhere that sort of trade off of what your family did for a couple of generations?
Well, it is kind of interesting. We went down to one of the local liquor stores here in New York and just see the shelf. It's just full of all these white whiskeys. A lot of different variety. You can tell some of them look quality and some of them are fake imitations. You know, if you go and read the label, there's some products, a lot of the products are made with grain-neutral spirits, and then they flavor them. Some are actually flavored with sugar so that they now meet the qualifications of a liqueur. You can see that on the label. Some of them are very interesting in the fact that they call themselves whiskey. Some are made out of wheat. But, you know, by federal government regs, the only clear whiskey is corn whiskey. You get something like a White Dog. I don't know if they call themselves whiskey or not. But to be whiskey other than corn whiskey, it has to go into a barrel. So all these are white, so I don't know what trick they're doing to circumvent the law, but I just think there's only like three really corn whiskeys on the shelf.
I've heard that at some of them you might find a barrel that gets used for a day or two at a time, not enough to change the color, but enough to call it legally whiskey and stuff like that. But are you surprised by what we've seen as this sort of explosion in small craft and farm distilleries like what you've been doing for 25 years?
Well, I tell you, you know, I was a lone wolf for a long time. It's kind of nice not to be the only one on the shelf. I mean, over the years, people looked at it, you know, with skepticism. What's this guy doing, you know? But now, with others on the shelf, we've actually developed a whole category of whiskey. I'm actually proud to be a part of it, and I feel like I was even the guy instrumental in helping it develop. So, yeah, it was nice to see them there. And some of them are, I haven't tried them all, but some of them are good. Some of them you wonder about, but I'm glad they're on the shelf. Glad to have competition, but I think we're still the only one, though, that's doing the whole gamut. We actually raise our own corn and do all the malt, yeast, right on the spot, and cut it there, bottle it there, and ship it out. So we still pride ourselves to be number one.
And obviously there's no age statement because you're not putting this in barrels at all, right?
That's right. We don't use any barrels at all. Corn whiskey is not required to be in a barrel, so we don't have to do the little 50-second trick or something these other guys are doing. Yeah.
You ever put it in a barrel just to see what would happen?
Yes, we have. And, you know, in fact, I got a barrel at the house now that's 20 years old. One day we're just going to have to crack it open and see what's in there, huh?
If the angels haven't gotten it all,
well,
right?
Well, the angels are getting their share. I can tell. It's not as heavy as it used to be. Yeah, the angels do get a little bit of that share. Although I do like to split it with the angels every now and then, too.
So you haven't opened this barrel in 20 years?
In 20 years. It's still sitting there.
Are you having fun?
Well, you know, that's the great part about this job. It's a great thing to do. I love cooking. I consider myself a master chef, you know, instead of just a distiller. Because actually you're cooking corn all the time. And each little batch is a little different. You're working with yeast. You know, you got temperature problems. Each time of the year, you got to worry about different things, you know. yeah, I enjoy cooking. I enjoy the project. I think I'm preserving a little piece of not only family tradition, but also an American tradition. So we want to continue to make traditional clear corn whiskey, original moonshine. That's our goal.
And this is really part of Virginia and Southern culture, too, because I remember visiting relatives in Virginia maybe the mid-1970s, and the end of the evening, the fruit jar would come out for the adults, and there would be some moonshine in there. And I know this is sort of a tradition in the South, and especially in Virginia, as you said, it was first made there. But tell me how important it is to keep this tradition alive for the future generations.
Well, you know, it very definitely is a Southern tradition. Not only will you find the clear moonshine original, but they'll also mix it with fruit. You'll see that a lot, peaches, blackberries. Everybody kind of has some somewhere in the closet they got from somewhere, and they like to show it off. But, you know, like you mentioned, it was back in the 70s, and here we are, you know, 40 years later, and it's harder and harder to find it. Your regular guy, you know, these old-time shiners are dying off, and they're not passing it on. It's getting to be a dying profession, so I feel by making original moonshine here, we're going to keep the tradition alive. Just a little thing here, interest that does happen. We notice in Virginia there, we get a lot of my neighbors will come and buy the original moonshine, take it home, put it in a quart jar, and give it away for Christmas. Because they can't get the stuff out the woods anymore, yeah. So that's kind of neat.
So they keep that tradition alive, but they're doing it legal.
Yeah, they're doing it legal. So that's kind of neat. Yeah.
And not many of the old shiners have gone legitimate and gone to licensed distilling. Why do you think that is?
Well, if you've ever been caught or had any history of getting involved with illegal moonshine, then the government will not give you a license. So that slows a lot of them down. Being the first craft distiller in the United States, we have a lot of those wishful thinkers come by. I tell you, we have one or two a week coming by. And, some, you know, are never going to get it, and some get it. They go home and work it out, and by God, you'll see it on the shelf, you know. But, yeah, you're right. It's not as many would go legal as you think.
Are a lot of them, would they go legal if they could?
That's another good question. You know, the taxes are quite high. And these guys have a lot of these little speakeasy bars, you know, around, and they make good money. So whether they'd even want to be legal may not be the way to go, because Uncle Sam makes a fair share of this bottle, I can tell you that.
What are your plans for passing this on down the line to keep it going?
Well, I have four sons, and we have two of them now that seem like they're interested in continuing. You know, since they worked there, grew up there, you know, helping me cook and mash and bottle, you know, as they got to be college age, they couldn't wait to get out of there. But slowly they're drifting back, so I think this tradition will continue on to the fourth generation, so.
Especially now that they can see it's a viable business too, right?
They like the idea that I'm starting to make a little money now. So that, you know, that impresses them. So I'm sure they'll be back.
Now your wife, Jeanette, is sitting over there, and she's been sitting there patiently and quiet the whole time. But I got to ask, and let me just sort of walk over here. So we're not stretching the microphone cable all over. What did you think years ago when he said, I want to do this and I want to make a business out of it? Did you think he was nuts, or were you behind it? What did you think?
Well, yes, I thought he was crazy. But I always support Chuck, and if he wants to do something, I was stood up right behind him. And I'm very much involved in it now, too.
Did your family have any history in this or at all? Or where is this, was this something that you found out about after you met Chuck?
No, my family was not in it. It's solely Chuck and the Millers.
Are you surprised by how it's grown over the years and how successful it's become?
Yes, very much so. I was talking to the kids the other day, and I said, do you believe this is happening? Our younger son, Zeb, made up a song about his dad called Moonshine Man, and he sang it the other day during a bluegrass festival that we had. It was really neat. He plays harmonica while he does the banjo, and then he sang in between. So it's just amazing how it's gone. I think his kids are also accepting it in a different fashion, more so than all that hard work.
What do the neighbors think when they smell that corn mashing and cooking up?
Oh, some of our neighbors love it. Nobody complains. It's very good whiskey.
Tell me about the value of a moonshine like this when it comes to mixology, because I know that a lot of bartenders around the country are really trying, and around the world are trying to use white spirit and white whiskey and white dog in whatever form they can get it in cocktails. What does this lend to a cocktail that a traditional aged whiskey might not do?
Well, I mean, like as you said, I think there's definitely been a resurgence in interest in these classic American spirits, like, you know, a moonshine or an unaged clear spirit. And what you get from it is it's got a unique flavor profile to it, but it's also very versatile. So you're fairly limited when you can come to aged spirits because of either the smokiness or the, you know, those flavors and aromas that get imparted by the barrel. When you work with a clear spirit like moonshine, you get to, you know, kind of, it opens up the field and you get to try a lot of different things. So, you know, one of the cocktails that's been most popular for us is, you know, variations on Bloody Marys, but using a clear whiskey, which, you know, normally you would never think, oh, whiskey with a Bloody Mary, but because, you know, it is kind of versatile, it has a little sweetness to it, it has different dimensions to it that it kind of adds and complements a savory, spicy cocktail like that. But at the same time, you know, you can also use it in traditional sour cocktails. You can use it in spirit-on-spirit cocktails. We do a variation of a Manhattan here, which, you know, traditionally is a bourbon and a rye, but we've been trying it today with a bunch of people, and it's great. You know, it just kind of gives you another take on it, but the moonshine is able to stand up. But it, you know, like one of my mixologist friends said when he first tried it, it plays well with others. So, you know, it always seems to be able to complement other cocktails. It doesn't really get in the way, but it, you know, is able to shine through,
so to speak.
Yes.
I would imagine you could probably also cook with this, too. I could see doing some cooking with this as well. And Jeanette is grinning over here. And so tell me what you can do with this cooking.
Well, I make a gravy and put moonshine in it, and I pour it over chicken and bake it in the oven. But I do the peach moonshine, where you put the peaches in the moonshine, let it sit for a little while, so it gives it the flavor of a peach. But it's good. And then I have tinkered with peach fudge, moonshine fudge, and I've also heard of moonshine cake. Now, I haven't tried that yet. I have to try that one next.
Now, you could probably also do a moonshine bread, too, or something like that. I could see this with, like, a banana bread, yeah. Almost. Put maybe a quarter cup of moonshine in there as well. Is this a category and a field that is really open for growth over the next 10, 15, 20 years? Or is this something that we're going to see sort of flash and then just sort of fade back over the next 2 to 3 years? What do you think?
Well, you know, the product itself, a traditional corn whiskey, has been in America now for 400 years. I can't see it going away in the next 10. So definitely will always be here. Will it be mainstream number one? I mean, you know, certainly going to go to a high priority, but probably drift back a little, but it'll always be here. It'll always be good sales. It's America's oldest drink, and definitely a drink from America. So it's a traditional product that we're proud of, and proud that we can help preserve a piece of America.
Can you see exporting it?
Yes, there is a lot of demand for American products overseas, and they do not have original moonshine or corn whiskey over there. And I get a lot of calls at the distillery. When are you coming over? England, we get them. China. People just wanting to do business with us. But we're taking it slow. We don't want to rush this. So I think the company I'm working with, the parent company, Dutch, will decide when it's time. But it's definitely gone.
I didn't do formal tasting notes on original moonshine, but there's very little corn taste to it. It's light, crisp, and almost gin-like in some ways, with a hint of grass and lime. There's a link to the original moonshine website at the WhiskeyCast website for more details. For the What I'm Tasting This Week department, I decided to do something different. As we heard from the Balvenie's David Stewart in Paris a few weeks ago, there are two different versions of his Tun 1401 single malt release available right now. Remember, Tun 1401 is one of the marrying tuns he used for vatting casks of single malt together at the Balvenie. Batch number one was available only at the distillery and sold out almost immediately. Batch number two has gone on sale in Europe and Asia, while a completely different set of casks went into batch three, which is arriving in the U.S. right now. Here's the thing. The Balvenie's PR folks sent samples of batch two only to writers in Europe and Asia, and batch three only to U.S. writers. They didn't cross the borders with samples of either one. But while I was in Paris for Whiskey Live, David poured me a sample of batch number two to bring home. So this may be the first head-to-head independent comparison of the two batches. Let's go in numerical order. Batch number two is bottled at 50.6% ABV. The nose is dry and spicy, with notes of allspice, vanilla, toasted oak, and dried fruits come out after a few minutes. The taste is spicy, with a cinnamon blast that fades slowly to reveal bananas and cream, honey and oak with just a hint of vanilla, and those notes all linger through the long finish. I'll give you my score for it in just a minute, but before I do, let's look at batch number three. It's bottled at 50.3% ABV, and the nose is immediately different, with notes of nutmeg, honey, vanilla, and oak in great balance, with some brown sugar underneath. The taste is rich and creamy, and just like batch number two, there's a lot of cinnamon in it. But as it fades, notes of honey, vanilla, oak, and dried banana chips come out. The finish is amazingly long, much longer than batch number two, with spices that remain subtle and not overpowering. The scores. I'm giving batch number two a 92, but batch number three gets a 94. Just a bit better balance and a richer finish did the trick. I'll be adding these scores to the free WhiskeyCast smartphone apps for iPhone, iPad, and Android. The Apple version is brought to you by the Glenrothes, and the Android version is brought to you by Ben Romick. My notes are also available at the WhiskeyCast website, along with the calendar of events, links for our Facebook community page and my Twitter feed, the print shop, and a complete archive of past episodes. The address is WhiskeyCast.com, and my email address is comments@WhiskeyCast.com. Support for WhiskeyCast comes from Redbreast Single Pot Still Irish Whiskey. Find out more at RedbreastWhiskey.com and join the Stillhouse to get your own personalized whiskey journal. WhiskeyCast is a production of Cask Strength Media, copyright 2011, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.